Oh boy.
Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. It once again, I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. I'm Carol Levine, I'm Vice President of NASCA. We do have Lori Golden with us tonight. I guess she tried to get a hold of me earlier. I've been in and out, so I didn't even have a chance to even look at the message. But anyway, I'll speak with her in a second. It's going to be on air. But anyway, let me read the NASCA mission statement. I want to get that out of the way. We have a singleness of purpose at NASCA to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so from two different perspectives, okay? Number one is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, and presenting the facts that show child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. Number two is offering hope for healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. All right, prevention, intervention, and recovery. The telephone number here is 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. If you want to call in, if you have questions you need answered, or if you want to just call in and be a part of the discussion, or if you want to just call in, I don't know, and listen on, you can do it also on your computer. You don't have to actually call into the station at all. It's always better if we have people to call in because it makes it a little bit livelier. However, I have tons of topics sitting in front of me, because I do an awful lot of research, and I have new stats and everything else that I think that people should know about, and why these stats are going up, and intimate partner relationships and so forth. Very, very bad. Okay, Lori, I'm sorry. I was in and out all day. I had so many things I had to do. I didn't even have a chance to look at my messages. You had called earlier or something, you said?
No, that's okay. Yeah, no, I just wanted to touch base, and I missed last show. I was actually really sick, right before the show practically. So I'm here this month, and I'm glad to be here. You mentioned in your email that anxiety and fear, people are calling you to reach out around fear and anxiety.
Yes.
Can you say more about that so that we can maybe focus on that?
Sure. I can certainly do that, and we can focus on it. And then towards the end, I do want to get some stats out also, because that's something that's important.
Can you do that now?
Too. Sure.
Do that now. I'm interested in hearing.
Okay. One of the newest stats that I have on the National Runaway Switchboard, okay, is 1.3 million runaway and homeless youths live on our American streets every day. That's outrageous. 1.3 million. And the number one state for human trafficking, by the way, is California. And then also, too, I didn't know that. And then also, too, is Texas, Florida, and, of course, New York, okay? So those
makes
are the states
sense.
Where the, those are the states that had the highest, okay, in human trafficking. And it's of any gender, okay? And at one point, it was 109,216 victims. Those were the ones that were not runaways. They were the victims. A lot of times they're out in their yard. They're walking alone down the street. Of course, with the border, the way that it is. I was just getting into research on that before the show started, and I don't have it this time, but I will have it for another time. Those stats are going to go much higher, you know, Lori, because of it says teenagers. I had remembered it said around 16 years old were being grabbed as they come across the border and are being trafficked out.
It's the border, the ease that, you know, the back and forth across the border is makes San Diego really big on trafficking. I mean, this is such a beautiful environment, and we have human trafficking here.
Well, I do know back in 97, my husband's been gone now. He passed away, it's going on 5 years now. It was 4 years plus. And, yes, he was part of 9/11. Yes, he worked in the city for many, many, many years, over 20 years. And he was there on 9/11. And he did die from cancer of the colon, okay? He died in my arms. Mm-hmm. Very, very sad. But in New York City, I know that there was a lot of trafficking going on. I mean, at times I would go into work with him. I was working at Greystone Psychiatric at the time, and they'd give us a month off for our own mental health. They didn't, and that was all throughout the course of the year. Sometimes I would take a couple days here, a couple days there. And I would go into him, with him, into the New York City Housing Authority, and he'd have an easy day that day, okay, let's put it that way. And they would work with him because he'd do overhead lighting, being a cherry picker, always out in the air, breathing in the air that was supposed to be clean, ha, ha, ha. And we were in Lexington Avenue, okay, was very bad with the human trafficking. And at that time, they had a van going around that would actually pick up the teenagers, and a lot of them were teenagers, you can see by looking at them. And they had a program for them, Lori. This was a good thing. And they would take them inside of the program, excuse me, and work with them. They'd teach them skills, and they had, of course, the clothing was given to them that had been donated. And they had food and housing and educate them a little bit, get them their GEDs, help them get that. Excuse me, I have a bad throat. And all kinds of stuff to educate these girls so that they could go out maybe, you know, and get a better job. But unfortunately, you know, a lot of things with the human trafficking, of course, these kids don't want to be grabbed as they're walking down the street. Teenagers should never walk alone anymore. They should walk in a cluster, you know, of kids.
I agree.
It's just not safe, okay?
Teenagers do not believe, even though intellectually they know it, but their brain isn't developed yet. They really don't sense what the consequences are for their actions. So they'll go out and they'll go by themselves, and it's very dangerous for kids too, for any, you know, just for teens in particular, though, because that's who they grab for the trafficking.
I know.
Yeah, it's awful. Yeah.
It is awful.
It really is. Yeah.
You know what happened, though, in the city? I got word on this. Now, that program no longer exists. They didn't get the funding that they needed, and that was the end of that program. But they
now
were able to help.
Now, that's also interesting, that they didn't get the funding.
Yeah, I know. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And so under the bridge there, you know, at the Lexington Avenue, I'm from New York, so I know all the city. So, you know,
right.
In that region there, you'd see these kids. And that's all they are. They're children. Come on. They're still around 16, maybe 17. I saw a whole bunch of them that were young. And they'd take them into this facility. And it wasn't very big. It wasn't very large. They didn't have that many beds. But they were out on the street all the time, and almost every night, you know, bringing in girls. And it wasn't just girls. A couple times they had boys, too, as well. But it was more, you know, girls. And try to work with them, but there were a few too. You have to remember, a lot of them are drug addicts, and that's what the traffickers do. You know, they get them hooked on drugs. At first, they act like their boyfriend. Okay, they're going to be nice
yeah.
to them, and then
yeah.
before you know it, that's not what happens at all. Okay, and they're pulled out and they're pimped out on the street. And they're beaten mm-hmm. if they don't meet a certain quota. You know these things, but I'm letting people know this
yeah.
because we don't speak enough about human trafficking, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then we can certainly get into the conversations I have at 3 o'clock in the morning, okay? But what happens is that there are some girls, I have to admit, that, you know, they make a certain amount out on the street, but, of course, the pimp, you know, takes a large amount of what they make and give them piddle, if you will. And, you know, and if they don't meet that quota, they do get beaten. And some of them run away. They actually are able to get away from the pimps. But they don't want to work in McDonald's then or something, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because they know mm-hmm. that you can, yeah, you can make money out on the streets. You can. So
yeah.
There were a certain amount of kids like that. Now, in 1997, I did have some good years with my husband. That, you know, we got along well. And once he was diagnosed with cancer, he was like a changed man. Whoa. But, and that's unfortunate. But we would go to the city a lot because I love Broadway. And so does he. I mean, he did. He loved Broadway. And so we'd go to Broadway shows, and he'd take me into work with him at times. We'd go get tickets, okay, so we'd
mm-hmm.
have to stand in line and so forth. So I'd see all this stuff because we'd go around the projects also, too, where he worked. And Lexington Avenue is down in that area, down in that region. And I certainly know where Church Street is and where the Twin Towers were. And all this other stuff, because he had headquarters there, and he had to go there to get job assignments many times. So he was certainly in the air. But we decided to go to San Francisco, and I was really, really excited. Now, this is in 1997. Yes, there was a homeless population of people by Haight Street. That was one area. And Yeah. And I do remember this lady was sitting out, and she had a cat. Now, I'm a cat lover, okay? So, and she was homeless. And you can tell when a person's homeless, Lori, you know this, if their skin is all roughened, all right, their face is roughened,
yeah.
they've been out
yeah.
in the elements, okay? Yes.
Yeah.
So she was a lady who had been out in the elements, and she had a can of cat food that was empty. And she had the cat on a rope, like, you know, and she was asking for people to help give her money so she could feed her cat and also herself, too. Hopefully she wasn't on drugs. I didn't get that close. I was giving
mm-hmm.
to people, and I gave her a few bucks, okay. The homeless problem was nothing like what we have, I'm sure, and you would see more than I because you're there, okay. Than what
oh,
it is today.
There's a lot of homeless in downtown San Diego now.
Yeah, and you see,
yeah.
we took the trolley and we took the tours, and of course I went over there because I wanted to see the prison, because I wanted to see Alcatraz, because I used to work in detention. It was a lockdown facility. Police officers always there, worked with us, because those kids did commit adult crimes. So
mm-hmm.
I wanted to go through the Alcatraz thing, and what a that was a wonderful trip. It was a wonderful vacation for us to go and be a part of that. So I went through San Diego because that was part of the tours, too. You'd go, you know, you'd take those tours. So
right.
I know what I saw back then, and I see on TV what it is now and what you're telling me. And, my God, if that doesn't cause pain and anxiety for the people who are out on the streets and also for the people who see it.
Yes. It, what's happening here, because I have clients that live in condos downtown, and they feel fear.
Mm-hmm.
They see a collection of homeless people defecating and urinating, and it scares them, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's just such a horrible situation that so many people are homeless, and a lot of people that are homeless have really had mental health issues.
Yes. Yes, they do. They absolutely do. And that's a shame, you know. There were a lot of vets, because I went into the city to help feed the homeless. I was a part of a group. There were 13 of us. And we would feed the homeless. And what would happen is we'd have the vets also. And I can't imagine family members turning away the vets, okay? I don't know what the situations were. But I do know that at one point we were going through the Lincoln Tunnel, and this guy knew we were going to go through the Lincoln Tunnel. He got his wheelchair, and you know where you're walking, there's a place to walk on the Lincoln Tunnel because you have to maintain the Lincoln Tunnel. Yeah. So he got his wheelchair up there, and we stopped our truck. We actually stopped our truck, but luckily there wasn't a tremendous amount of traffic at that time because it was already 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. I don't know what it was. It was called the Midnight Run, okay, the Midnight Run. And I'm up all night, so it's nothing for me. You know? So, but anyway, we gave him all kinds of. They jumped out of one truck. We had a truck, and we had vans, and we had SUVs filled with clothing, food, whatever people needed. And they just gave him and gave him and gave him a whole bunch of stuff, and then jumped back in our vehicles and took off. And that's what we used to do. Now,
mm-hmm.
I would love to be able to go to the city and continue doing what we were doing, because that certainly is a good service also, you bet. But what I did find out, Lori, is that a lot of those people that were homeless, they came from backgrounds like us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So here we have these people today who are watching the news just like I do. I'm a news buff. I'll watch it for 3 hours. I don't care. That's just how I am. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they get terribly depressed because they're already, that's part of their problem. A lot of them are, you know, they suffer from depression. And or they're post-traumatic stress disorders, and it is a disorder, you know, when it engulfs our life where we can't, you know, go out and get a job if they're still working and they can't, you know, work as, you know, whatever. That's where it becomes a disorder.
Mm-hmm.
I had spoken to someone, they were saying it's PTS, and I go, no, it's PTSD, and why it's disorder. So, you know, people are very much filled with anguish and fear right now, which I don't suffer from PTSD anymore, but
mm-hmm.
I can understand why those that do, and they call me 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever, why they would be so fearful.
What kinds of calls are you getting? You mentioned it in your email that at 3 in the morning.
Yeah. Well, I'm known as Night Owl, so that's okay. If you look me up on the contact page, it says Night Owl right after that. So they're perfectly welcome to call me. And so the type of phone calls that I'm getting are actually people who are fearful for tomorrow. And they're starting to have terrible nightmares and flashbacks. They've gotten to a certain point in their healing journey. And then because of what they have to deal with outside. Now the masks are coming back, or much more so. It's going to happen again. Fauci has his way, and I don't know if he's right. I don't know if it's wrong. I'm not going to. I'm not a scientist. Okay.
Right.
So I'm not going to argue that point. Okay.
And,
and the school systems. A lot of these people that I deal with, they have children that are going to school. And if the school is shut down, the ones that are opening or have opened already, if they shut down again, then if they have a job, then they have to quit their job again and play teacher. And they don't know how to be a teacher because they're not a teacher. So they're filled with so much anguish because of the society, because of the world, that we live in today. And that's why I get these calls, because their PTSD levels, they're going backwards. And, they're having more nightmares. They're having more flashbacks, and so forth and so on. So that's basically what I meant when I had put that, in your email. So I wanted you to understand, what we're dealing with. How do you have advice for people? A lot of times people listen on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Maybe they won't call in. I'll give the number out again. It's 646-595-2118. That's 646-595-2118. You're a therapist and highly regarded. You've been a therapist for many years. Okay. I'm a counselor, but you're a therapist, so I'm going to listen to you. Okay.
That's all right. I'll listen to you, too.
Well, I always make sure that I have all kinds of stuff before I come on a show, because I continue my schooling right from my computer is what I do. All right, so the point is this, though. A person calls me, say, at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they had tried to go to sleep. Maybe they're a time zone. Now it might be similar to mine. Maybe they're central, okay? So if it's 3 here, it's 2 there, a.m.
Yeah.
And they've had a terrible flashback. They had a nightmare. They woke up. They can't go back to sleep, and then they're dealing with their flashbacks. Any noises outside, they're very hypervigilant also. A lot of people, and you would know that. I used to be hypervigilant. I still am to a certain degree, but not anything that I would, write home about, as they used to say, the old saying.
Oh, I was, I was highly hypervigilant at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So these people,
go on.
Yeah, we'll talk about hypervigilance in a second. Maybe there's something to talk about, too, because that's what a lot of them are suffering from. They pace. They pace. If they smoke cigarettes, they might smoke a whole pack, okay, in a short period of time because maybe the nightmare that they had was horrific. And and they become fearful. Then they start thinking. Their brain starts working. Geez, I wonder what's on the news. I might as well watch TV. They turn the TV on. They see more stuff that actually makes them more, hypervigilant, because they have no control over what's happening in the world today. And none of us do, So they start thinking, well, here we go. We're going to have to, self-distance again, 6 feet or whatever. And I'm going to have to be a teacher to my child. We're going to start this stuff all over again. And then they start really thinking about, the scientists, are they telling us the truth? A lot of us question that, So this is the type of thing, and their mind just goes brrr. I have to tell you that. You know what hypervigilance is? Brrr. Your mind just, flies, Mine does, too, at times. But what I do when my mind gets like that with all different thoughts of all different kinds is I will go outside, and I don't care if it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I might run into a bear. I got to be careful around here. But I'll take a walk around the house, take some deep breaths, do a deep breath therapy, that type of thing. And maybe go in, not make coffee, but maybe have a glass of juice, something that doesn't have caffeine in it, to try and calm myself down. And then I'll actually look for a funny movie, if I can find one, or something that's funny. So But what do you do? What would you tell people, you know, when they, if you were to get a call at 3 o'clock in the morning and they're so terribly filled with fear, fear about tomorrow?
Well, I really try to bring somebody, people need to feel grounded. So I will focus on starting with what they're sitting on. And do you feel the chair underneath you? I usually ask people to get on a chair that's solid, that they just, that they're not sinking into, and really pay attention to the back, your back against the chair, your buttocks, your legs, you know, the chair holding you up in, so, and put your feet on the ground. And it, you should, it's good to be barefoot because you can kind of wiggle your toes and kind of grip the floor that's underneath you. Because the whole thing about, you know, flashbacks is trying to get back to today. Because in the moment, you're safe. But when you're in a flashback, you don't, and you don't believe that. And so often I will focus on people's breathing because they're not breathing, and the lack of breathing increases the anxiety, because if you're not breathing, I mean, that is your basic life force, is your breathing and your heart. So if you're not breathing, it escalates the fear. And people, you know, I often ask, tell me what's in your room. What are you looking at? Tell me about your room that you're in right now. I ask them to turn on the lights. You know, it's really, I do that even when I'm with clients and they start to dissociate or go into a flashback of anything, of any sort. You know, the biggest thing is look at me, and if they can't look at me, I ask them to listen to my voice, and, you know, I ground. The most important thing is grounding someone and letting them be aware that they're sitting on something. That's kind of the basic, that you're sitting on something. And that your feet are touching the ground. Some people like to stand, people can stand and feel the ground under them. But the biggest thing is the breathing and noticing that what's around you. So I often say to people, if you are having flashbacks, you need to create a very safe spot. It can be the corner of a room, but whatever is in there needs to be what reminds you of who you are today and reminds you that you are safe today. Because, you know, I often say to people, the other thing that people can do when they have flashbacks is write them down so that they're not just, the act of taking a pen, it kind of grounds you in some way, because if you're not on the computer, but the hand gripping the pen and writing, it's a physical experience. And so that can help people to kind of take the whatever is out there and put it down on paper. And I think it's so important in this recovery that people have really work on creating safety in their home. That to me is crucial, because we have to have a place where we can feel safe. And, you know, some people will go into their closet and create like a bed on their closet floor. People do all sorts of things. They just need to feel contained, and that they're contained and they're safe. So whatever, I often ask people to put on soothing music, but sometimes people aren't okay with that. That's okay too. You can't, watching TV is the worst because it's too, you never know what you're going to get when you turn on the TV. And
right.
Using the computer is also not okay. And people often do that almost as a way to take them out of their abuse anxiety and put them into another state of anxiety that they control. So if you go on the computer and you start to get anxious, you're making that happen, so to speak. And that, for people, is very enticing because it shifts from that deeper abuse anxiety and creates another form of anxiety. It's just like shame. When we do shameful things, it takes us out of the shame of abuse and puts us in control. At least we're doing what's bringing the shame to us. It's just how people cope. And I often suggest to people to, there are wonderful meditations about anxiety and fear. Listening to a meditation is good because you have something else going on in between your ears. You know, you're not just with your own thoughts. And that can break through and be helpful. I did a lot of that when I was in the height of my memories. I, like, would put on, as soon as I woke up from something, I put on something. I had different options. And back then, you didn't have the Apple phones where you could just go on and listen. But I had CD, tapes and different things that would address my fear, my aloneness. Aloneness was a big thing because...
Right.
When we feel, there's a certain kind of aloneness that is specifically connected to abuse. It's a barren, cold aloneness, like there's no other person in the world but you. Because that's what a child experiences when, especially I know for me, behind closed doors, I was alone with my father. There was nobody else that I could yell to or say, help me. So it was whenever I went into that kind of aloneness, I really wanted to kill myself. I couldn't tolerate how awful and barren it felt. And then I realized it's what that aloneness develops, how we develop it in our abuse, because we are alone in it.
Yeah, we absolutely are.
I often suggest to people to get somebody, if they can reach out, like calling you, Carol. It's great because you're up at night. I did that when I first got into my, first having my memories. The best thing I did was connect with two other women that were at the same time going through childhood sexual abuse memories. And we would reach out to one another. I felt like they were my lifeline. you know, and we did this recovery together. If you can find somebody that would be your partner in recovery, that's wonderful to do too. But also asking people, like a lot of times people come in to see me that are in 12-step programs, and I often say, ask if there's anybody that has a night job where they can talk on the phone. Because a lot of times the aloneness and the feeling of being alone in the world occurs at night.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's scary at night. We're vulnerable. So you don't want to do anything that escalates. You want to reduce the fear. The people, interestingly enough, Carol, people have to be willing to want to do this for themselves. And that's where it gets tricky.
Well, I agree with you 100%. I mean, okay, I'm sort of like, I'm up all night. And it's not because it's not because of what happened to me. I think I've worked, five different jobs where I kept going from one job to another job to get more money because I had two children to take care of. My marriage was no good. I had to leave the first husband, right? And I thought he was a prince. He turned out to be the prince from hell, all right?
Right.
The prince he was. But anyway, okay. So even if I liked a job, I would leave it, and it would make me so mad at times, but I had to make more money. And they would send me to school, okay, because I had to meet the requirements, of the state.
Right.
I had to.
Right.
But
right.
I'm used to those strange hours is my point. So for me to stay up all night doesn't really mean anything as long as I can sleep sometime during the day. I have to get some sleep, don't I? So.
Yes.
I am alone, and I admit that there are some nights I don't get phone calls, which is good. I end up falling asleep on the couch, then I get up and take a shower and get to bed probably around 5 or 6 or something and sleep until noon or whatever. But I will not go to bed without a shower. Now, that's one lasting thing with me because I always felt dirty.
Yeah.
And I remember, when I was a teenager, incest in my family too, my brother, he wouldn't leave me alone. And no one cared, all right? So I always felt dirty. And I would actually rub the washcloth over my skin at times until I almost bled. I mean, my legs would be sore and I'd be sore other places,
Yeah,
and,
I did too.
Yeah, I think that's very common, especially amongst those, who experience incest. And then I had my pedophile uncle first, and he wasn't by blood. He was through marriage. But I still think you call him an uncle, though. Well, that's to me, that's still incest. Sorry. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. And so between those two, and then I had a lot more after that. Ew, gross. I won't get into it. But and this was gross enough. But I started to really, bathe hard, at a certain time in my life. And yes, I think it's from what we went through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to this day, I'm not a kid anymore, but I still get in the shower. And no matter what time it is, and I still wash. I catch myself scrubbing a little too hard. do it the right way.
Yeah.
Yes. Some things never leave us. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. No, some things don't, but they don't stay. Like they're kind of, they come in. It could be something small, it suddenly it comes in, and then you have ways to put it to rest. And so I never feel like I'm shaken by memories anymore. I'm not shaken by the dark. And I do a lot of things to make myself so that I can feel safe. And I think I've shared this before. I have a guard dog, and I love having guard dogs. I mean, they're wonderful. So I never feel that sense of somebody can come in when I'm asleep. And because I didn't want to live in that fear anymore. And
right.
But these are things that, you know, life is filled with unexpected things. And there's no way to never have fear in one's life. It's what you do with it.
Oh, boy. Lori, I'm losing you. Hold on a second. Are you there? Can you hear
you
me?
You are?
Yeah. Were you away from the phone, or is it my phone?
No. No.
Okay,
I'm
grabbing the
other
phone.
I never understand.
Okay.
No, I'm...
Okay, now I'm on another phone. I mean, I turned this one off. I get so many phone calls, and then, you know, this is what happens. And I don't like using my cell phone because it's always jammed. I have too much stuff on there. All right, so you always, are you there?
Yeah.
Lori? Okay.
Yeah, I'm here.
So what you, okay. Geez, last night I had to get off because we had a terrible, terrible storm, and everybody could hear the thunder. It was so bad, okay? It was that bad.
Back east, there's been a lot. The weather's been crazy.
It's terrible. It is terrible, I have to
admit.
So but if you lose me, don't hang up, okay? And I'll call on another phone, okay? Because I don't want to lose the show. We have a good show here and good conversation, and you're teaching us a lot. So, but I can't help where I live here. I'm going to move. I'm going to get out of the woods. Seen enough of the bears. Seen enough coyotes. Oh, yes. I've seen enough of them. And I'm more of an urban person. So I'm ready to leave. I'm going to put the house up for sale soon. And it's a nice place where I live, Lori. But on the other hand, it's not meant for me. That's all. So can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to bring the other phone in and put it back on this charger here. So anyway, you were saying that you prepare yourself, in case, to keep yourself from suffering, from having certain things that you go through.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I don't want to live under fear. And, I know that the fear that I lived in was in my childhood. And the fear is different. So, there is a situation come up. Like, I have a medical situation now, and no question about it, it brings up fear. And of the unknown, of what could happen. And what I do with that is I use my spirituality to ease it. I might have a visualization of handing over this medical condition to the universe. You know, I meditate. I really come back to today. I don't sit and go off into the future in thinking. I'm really good. You know, my fiance died in 2002 unexpectedly. And one thing I learned from that experience is we really do only have a day at a time. And so it used to be that I thought there were monsters in the closet. It's kind of like abuse is like you have this dark space that has a door and you know there are monsters in it and you never think to open the door and shine a flashlight in there. are they really monsters? So we have to challenge ourselves when we start running with our thinking. What I often tell people is to write down all of your anxious thoughts and then number them from the most intense thought to from 1 to 5. You kind of number each one. And then you ask yourself, is there a solution for this fear that I have? And a lot of times there are solutions. You have to really think about, is this a fear that I can bring a solution to, or is this a fear that happened in the past and I believe it's going to continue to happen now, or is it a fear that I have to connect with either a higher power or something spiritual outside of myself so that I can feel like I'm not alone in the universe.
Right.
You know, I think we all see it. What often happens is people are triggered and suddenly they feel afraid and they don't know how they got to suddenly feeling afraid. And that's part of recovery, which is to start to pay attention to the things in the day that trigger fear. A lot of times people don't know what fear is. Like if someone is obsessing, that's fear-based. If someone is raging, that's fear-based. Our rage can be fear-based. You know, what are we afraid of when we, you know, what am I afraid of when I get so angry? And usually it's about you're not going to get your needs met. And so you got to understand fear hides in many different ways. It really does. And people mask it by food addiction, drugs, alcohol, men, gambling, betting. I mean, people mask fear in a lot of different ways. And you have to learn how to not act out the feeling of fear, but try to understand what you're really afraid of. And unfortunately, you know, we got to open that closet door and shine a light on our abuse if we don't want to be fearful in today. And that's what I say to people, you know, you never learned how to keep it in the past. It constantly comes in at you in the present, even though they don't, people can't identify often what's going on. So,
well,
the more
you know, a lot of times they're stuck, though. That's a problem, too. They're stuck in the past.
Right. But that's when I say to people, you've got to get help, because no one can recover from abuse alone. You can't recover from abuse just by books you read. Or people will say, well, I really read a lot of self-help books. They're great, but they're not in place of getting help,
right.
Getting support.
I agree with that. Mm-hmm.
You know?
I agree. Mm-hmm.
I couldn't heal myself. The only way I could heal was by being involved with other people. Particularly my shame.
Can you talk a little louder? I'm going to make my phone louder, too. Hold on.
Okay, that's
better.
Am I okay? Okay.
I think we're both okay. Go ahead. I live in such a wild area. I agree with what you're saying because, you know, look, I wrote a book years ago, and I know you've written a book. We'll talk about your book. I'd like to talk about your book. I wrote a book way back in 2010. I can't believe there's, you know, 21 already. Because those years
from
2010. It's nuts.
I know.
It's nuts.
It's amazing.
And it's scary, too, all right? Those years went so fast, and I don't think I was even having fun, all right? Let's put it that way. But, you know, the point is that, people, they do get stuck in the past. And this is one thing I'm dealing with a lot at 3 o'clock in the morning. Yes, they're fearful. Yes, they suffer from hypervigilance. Yes. I mean, I know all the wording to use because
I
got all the training. I know this. So, to get them to want to get out of that rut, too, is a hard thing. I mean, I don't know if it was you or someone else who had come on. Oh, I know who it was. She said that she feels that people many times like being where they're at so they get attention. I don't know how I feel about that because I'm not saying that maybe there are some people that feel that way. But on the other hand, who wants to be sad? You know, we have to get that up and say, just say, you know, look, I'll look at it. Let me go get the help that I need. I've read help, you know, self-help books, you know, things like that. My book was simply my memoirs, you know, from 2010, from my whole life, and got written in Japanese. I was pretty proud of that. And, all kinds of stuff. I didn't expect that at all. I don't even know how it happened, but anyway, it did. Although I used to go and get my nails done a lot, and they were Japanese. Now, I gave them a book. I don't know. Who knows? I don't know how it happened. But anyway, the point is that when people need help, I mean, you know, where they're going to get down to the real nitty-gritty, memoirs are wonderful to read. They can identify with a lot of things in that. Or if it's not a memoir, maybe it's by books written for self-help, like you said. But it can only go so far because you need to have, I mean, this is my opinion, okay? If you're very suicidal, say you're a suicidal person. I've caught 3 people in my life trying to commit suicide right in the middle. It's like I have antennas for that. I tried to commit suicide, and maybe you did too. I don't know. You'll talk about that. So what happens is, you know, people do need to go and get help, and there's no shame there. There's no shame with that. Not at all, you know, to go and get that help. And so often they put the blame maybe on themselves. Well, maybe I could have done something different. You know, or maybe they were enjoying it a little bit, or maybe they thought that that was the way that people show love, because that's what they've been told by, you know, the pedophile. This is how I show you my love, by, you know, by having sex with you. And then these kids grow up with such a wrong idea. Everything is, you know, out of proportion as to what is love, what is being, what's not appropriate, what is appropriate, and then they become very promiscuous many times, looking for that same type of, talk, like what they got from their abuser. They want that, and then they can't find that same type of talk where the abuser is telling them, you're so pretty, you're this, you're that, you're smart. And all this other stuff, and maybe they didn't get that at home. Okay, maybe it's a relative that's giving it to them. Or maybe it's a pedophile off the street. Doesn't matter. They tell them, I don't have to tell you, but we're telling the public, that they have their game. Okay, they have their game.
Yeah.
And this is how they get their prey a lot of times, for more than one time or 10 times or 15 times, because he buys them, you know, or she. Huffington Post had a whole list of women teachers. I was telling someone on the phone just the other day who had called me that they should look at Huffington Post from a few years ago, because they had a whole segment on women teachers. They showed their pictures too.
And
you know,
what about
who actually? Yeah, go ahead.
didn't get.
Well, what they were doing is they were taking these kids, and they were pedophiles, okay?
Yes.
So I was happy to see, you know, a few years ago, you could still get a newspaper, maybe, you know. Mm. So this whole thing was put online anyway, and that's where I actually got it from, not from the paper itself. But it shows how many women pedophiles there are, too. So I think we should talk at times, you know, and include them, because there's not as many, but there are a lot, okay? The numbers are not that different.
My mother is,
mm-hmm.
My father did physical awful things to me. My mother was very much a part of, like, she was lost after me. Like, she always thought I had such a great daddy and would talk about it. And look at me in a way that was sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, women can be touching you, and kind of it's confusing because they're touching you, but it doesn't feel right. It's like the same, you know, a mom, particularly if it's a mom. But, you know, it's so, sometimes the abuse is very subtle, but the kid feels incredibly uncomfortable and doesn't understand why they feel so uncomfortable.
It's almost like they can sense that there's something not quite right. I mean, I've been in that position, too, not with my mother. She barely even spoke to me. You know, but I've, you know, with other people. And then I think, too, once we have actually been abused, well, it doesn't matter if it's a male or a female who touches us, maybe not quite inappropriately, like you're saying. Maybe they're stroking our hair too much. And then they're going down to our shoulders, you know, think I have long hair. So they like to, you know, like go all the way down to the end of my hair. It's like right above my bra line. I'm going to get it cut. It's a little too long now, you know. Or maybe they like to tickle too much. Now, I don't want people to think that they can't play with their children, you know. But somehow there's that fine line. You know, it's one thing they tickle your kids or chase after them to certainly kids need hugs and loves from their parents, okay? But they have to be appropriate.
Well, what's important, yes, and what's important about this, because I was tickled abusively when I was a child by my friend's older brother. He was much older than us. And I would laugh, and he wouldn't stop. Terrifying. It was terrifying because I felt like I was going to die. It was horrible. So a lot of times when parents tickle their children, they have to pay attention to when they have to stop. And kids will tell you in many different ways, stop. You know, so tickling can be okay if it's done with the understanding that a child can call the shots and say when they need it to stop. But it's it was terrifying to be tickled. I thought I would die of choking, or it was horrible.
It is horrible. See,
yeah,
that's what my brother did to me. Yeah.
Yeah, it's
he would start tickling my feet. You brought it up, and you're quite right. I mean, yeah, I may have brought tickling up, but the feet. He would tickle my feet until, my God, it was uncomfortable. I thought I'd have to go piddle or something, all right? You're laughing so hard because it does tickle.
Yes.
Come on. And he was 5 years my senior, okay? So he was much larger than I, and I couldn't get away from him, okay? There was no way. And, you know, so I would have to take this abuse. And sometimes I would feel like I was going to urinate, for God's sake, because, you know, you're laughing so hard you can't help but laugh. And then you start to cry. That's what happened to me.
Yes.
You start to cry.
And you can't breathe. I know.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt like, I thought I was going to suffocate from tickling.
Yeah. Yeah. And then my mother would come walking into the room, and he usually got me in the dining room for that, on the dining room floor. I don't know why he chose that room, but... And she'd say, "Now cut that out," to my stupid brother. I call him stupid brother. It makes me feel better. Okay. And he'd stop, but the damage had already been done, and I knew I didn't want that weirdo near me. And then he ended up molesting me for years, from 9, and then at 14, he openly raped me. And no one cared in the house. You know, things like this happen, okay, in families.
Right. Right.
Yes, they do, but they're not supposed to. Okay.
Right.
And someone should care. I don't know. But
right.
Yeah, so it's just a horrifying thing what kids go through who are sexually abused. And Lori, I have to tell you, you know, with the first-time offenders, I mention this from time to time, I don't feel like they get the sentencing. Because don't forget, the first-time offenders, this is the first time they were caught. Now, you and I know that.
Yeah, it's the first time they were caught. It's not the first time they did it.
No. And yet they're treated and sentenced as a first-time offender. I think that, now this is just my opinion, but I think that, you know, whether you offend once, 10 times, or whatever, the trauma, of course, is there. And then with the first-time offenders who are finally caught, they should get much stiffer sentencing, because we know, just from studies show this, that they have up to 100, and they can have to have up to 128 offenses against them, meaning maybe 10 times with one kid, 5 times with another. You do the math. It doesn't matter. And point is, you know, and maybe, who knows, maybe it's even more than that. This is sometimes, you know, psychologists will come in and you know, they'll question pedophiles. And sometimes the pedophiles, you know, will openly and, you know, speak and be honest, maybe somewhat honest. And they'll say how many times, you know, they had maybe 10 kids, they had, but maybe 10 different times, so it brought up to 100, and then they had 5 more after that, 125, whatever the case is, and they will say that.
Yeah.
Well, for God's sake, let's get the statute of limitations gone. There shouldn't be any.
Yeah, I know.
And also, with first-time offenders, all right, this is something for people out there to work on, too, with the first-time offenders, don't give them a slap on the wrist. You know,
no,
what you do is you give them a much 10 years. Give them 10 years. At least 10 years.
Yep.
And, you know, Lori, the inside, because I've worked at prison systems, they don't like
I know.
Pedophiles.
I know.
Yeah.
And because,
well, you and I
and
know
that's
this,
because
so we're telling
a lot of
people.
People a lot of
Go
people
ahead.
In prisons were sexually abused.
Yes, they were.
So.
We used to have stats on that, and I'm sure that, with the females, I think, I remember stats at one point saying that over 70%, all right, had been abused sexually one way or another, okay?
Yep.
Now, that's a very high number, okay, when you think about it. And with the men, I don't remember, but you know what? Since we're talking about it tonight, I will know next time. I will look it up and get the newest stats on that. But the point is, when kids are horribly, horribly abused as children, then they have not just PTSD, but, you know, then they have complex PTSD. Because I'm trying to tell the people out this, okay, you and I know this, but anything that's done more than once, repetitively, that type of behavior, time after time, it's much harder for a child to heal from complex post-traumatic stress disorder than, and then a child who has, and I don't mean just, don't get me wrong, PTSD is awful, but complex is worse, and that's from being abused many times. Go ahead, you take it from there.
No. I had from the age of 5 to 16.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I had complex PTSD. And back when I first got my memory, and that was in 1987, this first had flashback.
Mm-hmm. Are you, Lori, are you doing a little something different with your phone?
No. You're not, you can't hear me? No,
I can hear you now. I'm having a little trouble from time to time. It's not going to ruin the show at all because it's maybe the people can hear you. Maybe it's on my side. Okay, so keep talking.
I don't know. But I completely got distracted. What was I saying? I don't even remember what I was saying.
I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Talking about, that's okay.
With complex PTSD.
About complex PTSD. I mean, that was like my whole upbringing. I was being abused on and off, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, my father went through periods where he would abstain and then went through periods where I just knew he was going to start again. You know, I knew he started looking eyes, and the eyes, I felt like they wanted to eat me up alive, those eyes.
Right.
You know?
Oh, yeah.
But, yes, complex PTSD, I mean, again, you know, when you're a child, even if you've been abused one time by an adult, it sets you up for believing that adults are, it's like adults can be safe. You're taught that it really makes it difficult to trust adults, even if you've been abused one time. It doesn't matter because the impact on you is so severe. You know, you don't know who to trust. Then you have a secret. Many people don't tell their family because they're told not to. And so now you carry a secret, and secrecy brings shame. And then you believe it's your fault. So, you know, I have people that come in and have only been abused, they can remember one time sets them up for a lifetime of issues that stem from that one experience. It's really can have a tremendous impact. So I don't want people to think if I've only been abused once. Or the other thing that people often when they come in to see me, they have this belief that intercourse, rape, is the only, that means you were sexually abused. And that doesn't. Sexual abuse runs from mild to severe. And it could be the way get this creepy feeling, and you know something's creepy, but you don't know, you don't understand what it is. You just try to avoid that adult. You know, kids really are in tune with how adults sexualize them. it's amazing how in tune they are. And it's more amazing that people don't believe when a child tells that an adult was creepy.
Right.
It's amazing how.
Well, you know what, Lori? I don't mean to interrupt you. I just don't want to lose
you.
No, go on. What bothers me, and you see what you just said there is so important, that they don't believe in what the child says. But you see, this is why we advocate so with the parents. If parents would teach their children, all right,
right.
What's appropriate, what's not appropriate, and that
yep.
they're going to be there for them, okay, anytime. Now, this is, of course, in a good home, right? I didn't come from one.
Mm-hmm.
Father, you didn't either, you know. But
no,
we're speaking
I didn't
with normal,
come from a good home.
No, me neither. Okay, so we'll talk about the normies, okay? The normal homes, okay? It
mm-hmm.
should be a part of parenting. If they would sit down with their children, and I said
yep.
this last night on the show, role play, because we on our website, that's NASCA, NASCA.org, NASCA.org, okay? We have so much information on our website. And under prevention,
yep.
intervention, and recovery, you know, it we have articles of how to teach parents to actually speak to their children. There's a very good article there with David Pittman. And David Pittman
mm-hmm.
actually, you know, teaches you, you've probably seen it, where how to, what wording to use. And
yes.
your demeanor also. And for God's sake,
mm-hmm.
I believe that, and he does too, use the body parts because that's what they are. God gave us a head. He gave us a neck. He gave us breasts if you're a girl and a vagina if you're a girl, okay, and a penis if you're a boy, whatever. Talk about the body parts and don't change the tone of your voice. Because
exactly.
you see, what happens, you know, with parents that feel funny about, and I run into this, okay, where parents say, number one, they want to say, I want them to stay, you know, innocent for as long as they can.
Oh,
you don't do that.
I know. I have heard so many times parents feel that they don't want that in schools because the kids should stay innocent, and
and you know it's
I love
so
it.
Annoying.
I know it's
so,
really annoying.
It's very annoying because people, they don't understand that they're not doing a service to their children. They're doing a disservice because we do not live in an innocent world.
No,
so that's why I believe we should be, you know, a part. There should be a part, absolutely, of parenting. So if
yes.
you read that article, okay, David Pittman, look it up. It's very good. He teaches you, there's certain pages where it's brought up how to speak to your children and to get
yep.
over that fear and because you're keeping them safer.
Yep.
Now, what I want to do here is I want to talk about your book because I don't think I've ever spoken to you about your book before. It's called My House of Lies. Why don't you tell us about that? It says Awakening from a Childhood of Sexual Abuse. Go ahead.
It's my journey as far back as being a child when the sexual abuse began. It's not told as a therapist, you know, a perspective of a therapist. It's my real life experience. It's kind of like I have at different times I'll be screaming in my head, mommy, mommy, you know what I mean? Like I wrote as if I was that little girl and what the experience was like, trying to get from like, I would be in my bedroom and everything would come alive. My butterfly ceiling, that I had butterflies on the ceiling, they would turn to black. I had my doll's eyes were black. I mean, everything came alive in my room. It was terrifying. you know, the alligators under the bed. So I had to find a way to jump from my bed, the end of my bed, into the hall. And I'd make it to the corner, and I would look down the hallway, and Carol, it seemed so far. I would look down. I had pictures. I drew pictures about this too. Hallway, and they seemed like an endless journey. And I'd be sitting there in the corner, wanting to go back to bed, being too afraid, wanting to go to my parents' bedroom, thinking at I was seven in one of these memories where I could get help, but I was too frightened to go that direction. So I like sat as if I was attached to the wall. And I always pictured a big, I think I shared this before, but I pictured a big ape that lived on the, I was on the second floor. And so our bedrooms were on the second floor. On the first floor, where there was banisters, I pictured an ape living behind the banister. I could see him, this ape, so clearly. And it's interesting because when I got my memories, I thought how creative I was. My father had hair all over him. And for me, he was like the ape. And
right.
But I really believed there was an ape there. And so when I got older, it became something else. So I really take you on a journey of growing up as a child, the real stuff that children go through, because I remembered so clearly the stuff that I ended up writing about. I mean, I had no memory of any abuse when I came into recovery from drug recovery. When I got off drugs 6 months later was when I started to have flashbacks. And then after that, I realized it was my father. But so I talk about my eating disorder, you know, how what it was like in my relationship with my mother. I don't talk about my brother and my sister. I keep it to just me and my father and my mother mostly. And not trusting her and trying to, I describe getting abused at night, and then the light felt so intense in the morning, like almost like you bad girl, you know, like this, the light was so disturbing to me in the morning. And then I'd go downstairs and I'd have to face my mother, and I would be very, you know, like quiet, because I didn't know. She would say, "Oh, honey, how did you sleep?" You know, and
right.
What am I gonna say? So I really described what it was like being a child in day-to-day living in my home and nighttime living, the difference between my day life and my night life. And
right.
My clients had what they say they get from it is they can relate to a lot of what I went through, because I describe things pretty vividly about what it was like to be a child and the kinds of things I had to go through. And the book starts out like a mystery, like a suspense, like I'm in the shower and I feel like someone's going to come up, and I have to pull the shower curtain away really fast, because my father would come in when I was taking a shower in my teen years. And or he would come in at any time, but particularly in my teenage years. And so, you know, I talk about drug, you know, my drug addiction and how that helped me survive long enough so that I could get recovered. But I just go through my whole life in my whole growing up life, what it was really like as a child.
Well, you know, that's what people need to read, all right? Well, like, yours is a memoir, mine is a memoir. And I went through, there's a couple areas where I spoke childish because I was letting the child come through. And so I think you did a little bit of the same. A lot of people do that because this is how a child thinks. This is how a child feels. And I saw that movie Stand By Me, and I thought to myself, if I ever write a book, I'm going to write it like that. I'm going to put a couple things in there like that because it was so right on target because that's how children feel. We have the monsters. Mm-hmm. As far as the shower is concerned, now that you brought that up, it doesn't matter. If it's daylight, I'm not worried, okay? But at nighttime, there's sometimes I feel like, oh, God, I feel like this is psycho. And I pull the shower curtain aside.
Yes.
I feel like there's somebody in there. All right, maybe.
Yes.
And there's no one in there.
Yes.
You know.
Right.
But you get
like
that. There's that
sudden
terror.
Right.
Yes. We still
that
have
creepy,
that terror.
That,
that creepy feeling. Yes. Yeah, that there's someone.
Yeah.
Maybe possibly. My house is all alarmed. I don't have a dog. I have a cat. And I call her my she acts like a dog. She does. And I you know, I taught her how to say ma. When she gets mad at me, she goes ma. And she doesn't like what I'm putting down. So she's like my I just love this cat. I got her off the streets and people were they were throwing rocks at her. It was terrible. And my husband was he was able to catch her. And then she became mommy's little girl ever since that time, you know. So that's what I have in the house. She's my killer cat. Yeah. You know, she got a hold of a moth last night, a big one. Oh, gross. And I was trying to go. I had to turn and look the other way, you know, because she was chomping away. Oh, my God. Gross. But, but you see, with getting back to the terror. I can honestly say that even to this day, like the shower, I feel strange, and I have those feelings that there might be someone, you know, coming in there. And because when I was in the pedophile house, as I call it, being abused, oh, God, it was 176 times. Holy crap, now that I think about it. He wasn't able to enter me. I was too little. I was only six. But he would straddle me and do it that way. And of course, I'd be a mess because he would ejaculate all over me. But I would go into the bathroom, and I would run as quickly as I could after he'd go downstairs, and my aunt was down there lovingly making his breakfast and his lunch to go to work and all this other stuff, right?
Oh,
I had to live in this house. And
I know.
So I'd go into the bathroom, and I would I'd grab a washcloth, put it under the faucet, and use a little chunk of soap. I don't know why they didn't have bigger bars of soap in those days. I must be very old. I don't know. But anyway, they had these little tiny chunks of soap. They used to make their own soap at times. I remember that. How weird was that?
Yeah.
But, and they weren't poor people or anything. I came from wealth. It doesn't matter if you're rich, poor.
No, I know.
Or in between.
I know.
They'll let people know that, too. But I would take that little chunk of soap. And it didn't have any perfume smell to it. I remember that or anything like that. But I would quickly go over my body. That's the best that I could do, you know, quickly. I didn't want to get caught in the bathroom, you know, wiping myself off by my aunt. She'd wonder what I was doing. And
exactly.
He told me he'd kill me. He would kill me, okay. And he did try. You'd have to read my book to understand. Later on, he did try. So,
you know,
these things happen. They happen. This is the point. I'm trying to talk fast now because we're getting down to the end of the show. But these things happen to children. And if they don't get the help that they need, then you have they OD, they try to commit suicide. Sometimes it happens, you know, they commit suicide.
Yeah, then you get addiction.
You have all kinds of addictions, or you end up in prison, okay? You know, detention, then prison, whatever. So people out there, it affects all of us, okay, everyone. When your house gets broken into, maybe that kid was beaten up a whole bunch or sexually abused or whatever, and maybe they didn't have enough food at home, maybe they were neglected. So it comes from all different areas that we speak about on our show, the physical, the mental, the emotional, the sexual, the neglect, all of these. Kids without help, they grow up twisted. That's the word I use,
yeah.
Twisted.
Yeah.
So anyway,
yeah.
You have like 2 minutes, you know, and then we'll have to end the show. Maybe 3 minutes. I think my clock is a little off because I lost power last night. It was a crazy night. So go ahead.
You know,
give hope to the people. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I want to say that your story, that's what it is. It's who you. It's not who you are. It's what happened to you. And the symptoms of PTSD and is not your DNA. It's not, there's, and the best healing that people can do is tell their secret. Because I always say the number one thing to be able to heal is telling your secret. And it may be a therapist, but then you might want to tell a friend that you feel safe with, or you might want to tell somebody else. And I just, recovery is possible. I want to say it is hard work. It's not a quick fix. And nothing happens, you know, if you've been abused, especially if you've been sexually abused, or I'm going to just talk about sexual abuse, in your home or, you know, in your neighborhood or in your school, you have to tell somebody that happened, because it's the only way to heal from secrecy, from shame. Is the beginning of the healing of shame. So
I agree with you.
I'm glad people are here, and I hope people tell their secret. And I invite you to get on this show and tell your secret to me, to Carol, and to myself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, we certainly have the platform. You know, it's here. So on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. You know, I do have some people tonight that are listening through their computers that I know are, and they're new. They don't know about NASCAR. So I'm telling you guys out there, on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we do, you know, have people that come on and tell their stories. And if you know someone out there that's being abused, for God's sake, make a phone call. You can call. If you don't want to do it in your area, say you're in an urban area especially, whatever, you don't want to, you know, you can remain anonymous, number one. You call the 1-800-4-A-CHILD, 1-800-4-A-CHILD number, and they will help you. They'll guide you as to how you can be someone's hero, okay?
Yeah.
Because we all need a hero, don't we, Lori? We absolutely do.
Yeah, we do. We do.
Yes, and we didn't have that in our life. I want to thank you so much for coming on. And, you know, we had a very good show. It's just you and I, but, you know, we did a great job. Yes, we did. And you did a wonderful job. So thank you so much for coming on. And I'll see you next month at this time, okay, because you come on once a month. Okay?
You will.
So I have to end the show
month.
Now. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, honey, take care, all right?
You
all
too.
Right, good night now.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Dawn you are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.